program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
An hour earlier today, we've got a ball game coming up at high noon, Minnesota at Penn State. Tom Schroyer is in studio. A little chilly today. I thought spring was on the way, but I checked the calendar. It's still February, and it's Valentine's Day.
It is, Steve. We're excited to be here as well on Valentine's Day with Jim Vetter talking about family law issues. Was interested to hear Jim at the top of the hour, Bruce Hockovic, talking about people trading in weapons for roses. That might be a leitmotif for us today here.
That very well should go into what we're going to talk about here today.
What a deal. I should have thought of that. I'll take your gun and give you a rose. That's a good trade.
That might be the definition of a settlement, Jim, in a family law matter. I don't know.
It would seem a little unfair, but then again, we'll have to examine what the worth of the gun was.
Or the rose.
Or the rose, for that matter.
So Jim is here today, Steve, talking about family law and settling family law disputes. Jim is a shareholder in Moss and Barnett. He's been named as a rising star by the peer review service of Minnesota Law and Politics since, I believe, 2002. And he's the co-author with our other shareholder partner, Ed Weiner, of a chapter in the Family Law Financial Desk Book used by the MSBA. You might recall we had Mr. Weiner on last summer to talk about premarital agreements and postmarital agreements, and that's what Jim helped write the chapter on as well. And Jim is a frequent, prolific author and lecturer on a variety of family law legal topics. Jim, it is our privilege to have you here today to talk about creative ways to resolve family law disputes.
Thank you for that, Tom, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
We're hoping that our listeners will take occasion to this occasion to give a call. Jim is authoritative and is eager to answer questions that our callers might have, as Moss and Barnett has one of the largest family law practice area groups in the Upper Midwest, handling cases from literally states surrounding Minnesota as well as all throughout the courts of Minnesota.
Yeah, and I would even say beyond that, we get a number of states where we will do work in, particularly the snowbird states, Florida, Arizona. Again, I don't know that any of us are licensed there, but we do a lot of pro hoc vice, which is to say work where we associate with an attorney down there.
Very good. Now, Jim, the topic is resolving family law or marital disputes, and I know that's something that we use to call a settlement. Is that what you call it in family law as well?
We do. I mean, a lot of people are going to be more familiar with what's probably called a marital termination agreement or a stipulated judgment and decree. That ultimately is what you're trying to get at as a final document. But a settlement is a fair statement, Tom.
I remember when I was a young attorney, not so many years ago, I was resolving a case, and I came back to the office and expressed some disappointment because the matter had settled. And one of the senior partners said that by definition, if not everyone was happy, or if nobody was happy with the outcome, I should say, that was a fair deal.
And oftentimes we'll hear that from judges, mediators, other judicial officers will tell us the exact same thing. A good deal typically is when neither side feels they got everything they wanted, and neither side feels that they gave up too much either. And it really is something else because a lot of times people come into this and they say, well, look, I want everything I want, and I know what I want. This is my life after all. And when they don't get everything that they want, they sometimes have a hard time with it. But again, as you said, Tom, a good deal is one where somebody doesn't get everything they want.
Now, is it important to start thinking about the possibility of settling a family law dispute early or even before it gets into court?
Absolutely. In fact, you should start considering whether or not to settle your case and really how to settle your case before you even file your paperwork with the court. Many of our courts now in the state are requiring parties to come into their first court appearance, an initial case management conference, ready to settle their case or at least come up with ideas for how they're going to settle their case. The courts want to know, one, are you going to use neutrals to assist you in resolving issues? What issues are there? In addition, what discovery or other techniques need to be used to determine what all the information is to allow people to settle?
A few weeks ago, we heard from one of our other colleagues at Moss and Barnett, Ben Henschel, about the challenges that these difficult economic times were posing for people going through family law. Do you find that, or family law dissolutions of marriages, do you find that to be an issue as well?
Absolutely. I would agree with Ben 100% on that. We're finding that it almost was easier to settle cases several years ago. For instance, the house was typically a much more desirable asset. People felt like they had more. They seemed to be a little bit more giving. Given the present economic environment, people are frightened, and they're frightened to give up things. They're frightened to give spousal maintenance, which is a payment on a monthly basis to someone. They're frightened to give up certain assets that they feel they've worked so hard to generate throughout this marriage. So you see that there's kind of a mentality. People are concerned about it. Whereas a few years ago, you know, people seemed to think that the housing market only went up, stocks only went up, and everything looked rosy and good.
And are you also seeing other impediments to settlement, emotional baggage that parties bring to the table, difficult family situations as well, economic uncertainty?
I tell you, Tom, that is a key component of a marital dissolution settlement that you won't see in a lot of other cases. There is a real key emotional component here, and it's interesting because in a lot of cases, we tell people, look, you got to treat this as a business decision. Well, how do you tell two people who got together, not because they wanted to get into business together, but because they loved each other? They felt that this was an opportunity for them to show their love for each other, get married, and now at the other end, you're saying, well, wait a minute, put that emotion to the side. And let's just say, look, this is a business decision. That's very difficult for people to do, particularly when there are kids and other things involved. These things are almost all emotional.
I suppose that, you know, behaviors before that led up to the divorce can also come into play. Religious issues, issues of guilt, issues of family situations, all of that can be really barriers to whether the parties are able to talk rationally about moving forward with the rest of their lives.
Yeah, all of those issues come up, and oftentimes there's a reason that people want to get divorced. There's some single event that has happened or multiple events that have happened, and people want to touch on those. And it's hard for them sometimes to understand that, look, you know, we're a no-fault state. Minnesota doesn't care so much why you want to get divorced. They just want to get you divorced.
And are people also still bringing a fair amount of suspicion into these proceedings about whether the other spouse has been, for example, siphoning off assets or hiding assets somewhere? Are those issues still in play?
You absolutely see that. In fact, you see a lot of it now, again, with the current economic environment where people are concerned and worried about what happened to the money. Particularly, you'll find the spouse who hasn't been as involved in the family finances being concerned because one spouse is represented over a number of years. Look, our 401k has grown. Our house has got more equity. Look at our stock accounts. Look how great they're going. And now suddenly we're getting divorced and we don't have much of anything there or it's significantly less than we thought.
So it's an open book. Once this proceeding gets underway, that's an open book. There's no hiding anymore. You can try, but the court doesn't allow that.
That is absolutely correct. Once you get into this process, there has to be full financial disclosure. In fact, you're representing that as part of your final agreement that you've actually engaged and done that. And any agreement should have that. If you don't have it, one, you run the risk that you're going to come back to court at some future date on a fraud motion. In my experience, courts, referees, judges, they hate when they see that, and you're going to pay a consequence for that.
Our phone number on the program, 651-989-9226, or 1-866-989-9226. It is Minnesota Law. An hour earlier today, we have a ball game coming up at noon. Your phone calls always welcome on the program. Jim Vetter is in today from Moss and Barnett's Family Law Practice Group. And, of course, our host, as always, is Tom Schroyer. Here on News Radio, 830 WCCO. Welcome back, Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer, host of the program. Jim Vetter, our guest today. Family Law in the Spotlight. Phone number on the show, as always, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. We're an hour early. We have a ball game today at noon, Minnesota at Penn State.
Steve, we're talking this morning with Jim Vetter of Moss and Barnett about settling family law disputes. Jim, it's said that two can live cheaper than one. Is the opposite also true? That is, that two have less of a lifestyle than when they were married?
That is absolutely correct, Tom. And that is one of the key issues that you have to deal with in a settlement, is that suddenly you're going from one intact household that might have two incomes or one primary income, and people who have been working as a team to create an environment where they can both do that. Now you've got two households that are either going to live on that one income or two incomes, and it's difficult to do that. It takes a fair amount of budgeting. It takes a fair amount of working together and figuring out what people can do to assist each other.
What are some of the issues that people ought to be thinking about in their own mind as they're looking at the possibility of going through a divorce, or even if they've decided to do that and they want to start talking about starting a dialogue of settlement?
I tell you, Tom, and it depends, again, on what exactly the parties have, but in a lot of cases, one, you've got to be looking at custody, parenting time if you've got kids, along with child support. I encourage people, look at college education. What is it that you want to do with your child? What is it that you and your child or children have spoken about? Take into account income tax exemptions. They have some worth.
What are those?
Well, income tax exemptions is if one party can claim a child as an exemption on their income tax return and pay less income tax. I know that the federal government has been phasing out the phase-out of the income tax exemption. Well, that's kind of a mouthful there. But it's becoming more valuable for more parties. It used to be that there was one party it was more valuable to. Now it's becoming more and more that both parties can do it. Other things you should consider, medical and dental insurance. Who's got it? If you've got two employed spouses, who's got the better coverage, less expensive coverage? Again, keeping in mind that we now have two homes to support instead of one. We've got issues of spousal maintenance. Again, that's a payment from one spouse to the other, and there are a number of factors that go into that. You need to consider income, expenses. Does a spouse need retraining, reeducation? You can also waive spousal maintenance. Somebody could buy out of it. So you go, okay, well, is that something I can one afford to do? Do I want to? Do I want to know that at no point in the future that other spouse can come back and seek this payment from me? And there's some value to that. On the property side, you've got to look at what you have: businesses, real estate, retirement accounts, securities. You know, anything you've got there, be aware of, know what it is, and how you're going to divide it. And then security. If you're going to get paid out over time, how do I know that I'm secure in that, particularly now in this market?
That's like loan collateral that a banker might take on a loan.
Yeah. If somebody owes me, just by way of example, $100,000, and I know that that party is getting the house, do I want to be secured in the house? Again, you may have to put some restrictions on that to say, okay, if I'm going to do that, then do I need restrictions that they can't pull out equity? They can't refinance the property. They can't do a variety of things. So a number of issues with that. And just kind of continuing on with some of the other issues people need to consider.
Debts. Well, sure. I suppose we have to talk about the liability side of the balance sheet, too.
You've always got to talk about the liability side, and that's becoming more and more of an issue for people here as you see, okay, how do we divide the debts? Who gets what debts? And again, some of that you've got to look at, particularly if it's credit card debt, what's the interest rate on it, who needs to pay what, how much is available. Other issues people often don't think about, income tax returns. If you've been married, you've likely been filing a joint income tax return for the years of your marriage. And you've got to be concerned of, okay, if the IRS audits us at some point in the future, what's my responsibility? What am I on the hook for? I'd want to know that. I'd want to address that now. I know, Tom, as you're familiar, the IRS isn't going to care, but at least you've got some security knowing I can go back into the family court to address this issue.
Can you also take steps in these settlements to tie up how the parties are going to deal with their estates going forward? So in terms of what they're going to leave to their children, what their rights are going to be if they get remarried in that regard?
You absolutely can. And one of the key things that should be considered, even if it's not addressed in the agreement, is that what are you going to do afterwards? Oftentimes people don't change their beneficiary designations. And if that doesn't happen, you absolutely should.
So, Jim, we're talking here about creative ways to settle a family law matter. And when we come back after our break, we're going to be talking about some of the techniques that the courts have set up to facilitate people in resolving their disputes in family law situations.
Our phone number on the program, as always, if you want to call in and you have a question for Jim Vedder and Tom Schreier today, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226 here on the program. We're going to take a break for the news and weather. By the way, we're on an hour early today. We have a ball game at noon, Minnesota at Penn State. Big Ten men's basketball coming your way. And normally, we're on each and every Saturday at noon. It's Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett here on News Radio, 830-WCCO. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, each and every Saturday, normally at noon. We're on an hour early today. We have a ball game coming up at high noon, Minnesota at Penn State today. Mike Grimm and Don Zierden with the call on that one. Our phone number on the program, as always, 651-989-9226. That is 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. Tom Schreier, host on the program. Jim Vedder, our guest attorney.
Steve, we're talking here at this segment of the program about some of the devices, the procedures that the courts and lawyers have set up to facilitate parties in resolving their disputes. I know we've talked with Susan Rode and Ben Henschel about their work in helping to set these things up, and Jim, you've played a part in that as well. What is the lineup, as it were, of these kinds of tools and techniques?
Yeah, our courts have been very proactive in Minnesota about giving people the ability and the tools to use to get settled. And a couple of the primary ones are what are called the early neutral evaluations. They've divided them up into two. One is a social early neutral evaluation, and one is a financial early neutral evaluation.
When do these types of early evaluations come into play for this purpose?
Very early in the process. The courts want the parties, after that initial case management conference that we talked about earlier in the program, which usually takes place 2 to 3 weeks after you filed your initial paperwork, at that the court's going to say, do you want to do these? And if it's a social early neutral evaluation, because it involves children, I've had them get us down there into that the day of the ICMC. Otherwise, they try to do it, I believe, within about a week of that. And what it is it's a summary opportunity for the parties to go down, meet with two custody evaluators, one male, one female, and determine, you know, kind of hear the facts of our case. If we were to present this through a full evaluation, what kind of recommendations do you think we'd get as for custody, parenting time, holidays, vacations? And after they hear both sides talk, they will come back and give their recommendations. And at that point, the parties are able to either one say, you know what, we agree with that. That makes sense to us. Let's finalize an agreement. They can say, oh, I want to take some time to think about it. You know, it seems to me that it's a big decision. And, you know, they'll even allow you to come back if you feel like you need some additional information. The third thing is you can just say, you know what, we think you guys kind of missed it as part of this, and we want a full evaluation. That's what they're trying to avoid, because at that point, people become more entrenched. The kids start to get involved. There's interviews. There's observations. And it becomes a much more intensive process at that point.
Is there an effort, though, in this respect to isolate the child support and the child custody issues from the other kinds of issues that have to be discussed and possibly even to fast-track those for resolution and isolate the rest of the situation from that?
That is very true, Tom. They want to get the issues that only address the children and only the non-financial issues at that. So the child support and the insurance and all that kind of stuff, they're going to leave that for the financial early neutral evaluation. And that's an opportunity there to sit down either with an attorney or a CPA to assist you in trying to resolve your issues and your financial issues, that is. I tell people, look, figure out what it is that you've got the issue with. Do you need a CPA or do you need an attorney to help you out?
And a CPA, that's a certified public accountant?
That is a certified public accountant. Thank you for that, Tom. And really, when you need a certified public accountant is if you've got cash flow issues. You can't agree on what the cash flow is. You've got a business valuation issue, and you need somebody to assist you in determining what that is. On the other hand, if you've got a legal issue, then you should certainly get an attorney involved. At that point, the certified public accountant isn't going to be able to help you with the legal issue unless they are an attorney as well. And there are some out in the community who are both attorneys and CPAs.
Now, the attorney, does that person represent one party or the other or represent both, or are they pledged to be neutral like a court?
Pledged to be neutral. They don't represent either party, and their goal is to tell you, okay, give us the facts that you think the court is going to get, and we're going to give you an idea of what we think the court would do with it. And it's an opportunity, again, for the parties to say, look, before we invest all this time, effort, emotion, money into the process, that we're going to resolve these issues here, and this is kind of a way that we can get this resolved.
After that, if the parties aren't able to agree on the solution proposed by the early neutral evaluator, either in terms of child support for the social side or by the accountant or lawyer on the financial side, what happens next in the process?
You've got a number of options after that, and I encourage people, use all of them. I mean, one, the parties could just try to meet with each other and try to resolve issues. Second, you could go to a mediation, and a mediation is where the parties and or the parties and their attorneys will meet with a third-party mediator, a neutral individual, doesn't represent either side, but takes the position of I'm trying to get you people to reach resolution here. And it's an excellent opportunity. There's some excellent mediators out in our community, and it's a great way to try to resolve issues. Again, it keeps the contention down, which keeps the level of litigation typically down as well.
And I would assume in that process, it's important that people come to the table with the best intentions. Once again, full disclosure, that they lay all the cards on the table, that you need to go into it, as difficult as it is, to try and be as upfront and as honest in that process and, once again, put all the cards on the table.
That is absolutely correct. And I tell people to come in with an open mind. In terms of a settlement, you really have almost limitless options as long as you don't impinge upon what's best for children or, you know, have a financial resolution that is so one-sided as to be unfair. Courts oftentimes are almost always are going to enforce these and sign off on these agreements. So I say, look, come in and say, I'm going to listen to what the other side has to say, and I'm going to try to come at this from how do I solve the problem, not how do I create more problems, because that's ultimately what you're there to do.
Jim, there's, I know, as we talked earlier, a lot of oftentimes a lot of fear and suspicion, as Steve was alluding to as well, on the part of one party or the other to the marital dissolution, typically around issues like is there some hidden pot of gold, et cetera. How often does that come into play, and how often at the end of an expensive ride in litigation land do people actually find that there has been some kind of fraud perpetrated in that regard?
I tell you, you hear it quite often, actually. People oftentimes think that there's something suspicious that has gone on, and I tell people the easiest way to resolve that issue is to say, look, let's get the full financial disclosure. Let's look at their W-2s. Let's look at their pay stubs. We'll compare that against bank statements, and we'll see what comes in. If there's money missing, we'll ask him or her about it and say, where did that go? When you get the bank statements, you can also look at where the money's going out to. They're excellent resources in terms of documents to track the money. Now, in response to your question, how often at the end of the day do you find that there is this hidden pot of gold? Not often. And I'll say this. If somebody's burying a pot of gold in the backyard, you know, unless they give us the treasure map to go find it and the shovels to dig it, we're not going to probably find it.
So people should, in most cases, pull their horns in, try to cut a deal rather than fight to try to find that missing asset.
Unless you've got some proof that it's there. If you can show the money going out, otherwise it's going to be an expensive process to find out that, you know, what is on the table is actually what's there.
What's driving the courts to push for these settlement tools and for the parties to go through with them so much?
One of the big driving issues, at least initially, was to keep the emotion down and to keep the contention down. Oftentimes these people have to continue to live together with children. Now, more recently, we are seeing that with the economy being what it is, that people are courts in particular, they just don't have the resources that they may have previously had to give to this. I just attended a presentation by the Chief Justice a week ago, the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and he was telling us about how hard up, I don't say hard up, but the difficult times that our court systems are going to be facing because they don't have the resources.
And that comes to play in family court as well.
Absolutely comes to play in family court. They may not have the time to devote to your case that you would like. You know, whereas you may have said, well, look, if I go to trial, I want a three-day trial. They may say, I can't give you 3 days. I've got a calendar that's full. I can give you a day or a day and a half. And I'll often tell people as well, you know, litigation often isn't your best route simply because if I told you, Tom, right now, we're going to go to a random law firm. We're going to pick an attorney. could be a personal injury attorney, could be a criminal attorney. And I'm going to have them decide family law issues after they hear from you for maybe a couple of hours, they hear from the other side for a couple of hours. You'd say, you're nuts. I'm not going to go do that. But people do that with judges all the time. They say, I'm going to put my life in your hands. I'm saying, take control of it. It's your life.
Are there ways that parties can opt out of using the court system per se and going to an appointed judge, but instead get a similar ruling, maybe even a higher quality, have more control over the process?
Absolutely. You can use what are called consensual special magistrates, which allow you to have more control over the process. And I want to stress, I mean, we have some of the best judges in the country here. I think they do a fabulous job, but frankly, they're worked, and they're really overworked at this point. I've gone to more hearings where, you know, the judge has got a full courtroom waiting for motions to be heard, a variety of problems to be addressed, and that's just the argument side of it. That's not even taking into account the voluminous pleadings that they have to read. Now, with a consensual special magistrate, you can take control of the process because it's effectively a rent a judge, and you're saying, look, we've hired you to address just our concern here.
Who serves as what you call a consensual special magistrate?
Attorneys will serve as a consensual special magistrate. You've got to have somebody who's familiar with the law because you're going to be having them make legal decisions based on this. And what they will do is create a process that might be more conducive, one, to getting it settled, but two, to give you more time.
And so are these decisions made by these consensual special magistrates based on evidence that's presented? Is there a court reporter? Do they swear witnesses and take testimony under an oath to tell the truth?
And that's one of the nice things about the consensual special magistrate. You can kind of create your process to what best fits the situation. But yes, in a lot of cases, that's exactly what happens. You'll have a court reporter. You'll have evidence, testimony taken from people. Everything you would typically do in a regular court setting, it's just in an attorney's office or a mediator's office or somewhere else, and you can actually kind of use the rules of evidence and maybe ease up on them a little bit as well, recognizing that the rules of evidence aren't always best applied to family law cases where people need to tell their story. The rules of evidence, I think, are great in criminal settings and a lot of civil cases. In family law cases, you know, people need to just have themselves heard.
And if somebody doesn't like the ruling of a consensual special magistrate, do they have the right to appeal?
Absolutely, and you can preserve that as part of your agreement to use the consensual special magistrate.
We have more coming up on the program. Our phone number here on Minnesota Law, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. Jim Vetter is our guest attorney today. Tom Schroyer, host of the program, as always. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss & Barnett. Available online anytime at moss-barnett.com. We'll take a break and come back with more here on News Radio, 830 WCCO. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss & Barnett, each and every Saturday, normally at noon. We're an hour early today. We have a ball game coming up at noon, Minnesota at Penn State. We'll be back next Saturday at noon. We'll have more on next week's program. At the end of the show, we continue with Jim Vetter, our host, as always, Tom Schroyer.
Jim, in addition to the early neutral evaluation program and the use of special consensual magistrates, do the courts get involved in other ways in facilitating settlements of divorcing couples?
Yeah, they do. And typically they'll have a pretrial before you get to trial. And at that point, Tom, they want to know what are the issues, what efforts have been made to try to settle. And they'll come up with additional ways that maybe you can try to do it, such as, you know, could you use an arbitration process where you address some of the issues? Or, you know, is there just a issue that you want to have addressed? Could you go to a non-binding arbitration where you present your facts and you get some kind of feedback from an individual?
I imagine an arbitration could be very effective and even cost effective in terms of deciding how to split up all the pots and the pans in the cupboard sort of a thing.
Very much so. And we encourage people to do that with those issues. It's really not a legal issue when you're getting down to the household goods. You know, who gets the sofa, who gets the dining room table. At that point, the two parties can sit down and talk with an arbitrator and discuss and decide that. And the arbitration process, I think, is very well tailored to that.
Is it binding? If the parties agree, does the arbitrator have the last word on those issues that they would decide?
Absolutely can be. And in most cases we do that, because you don't want a non-binding situation where, you know, somebody comes back and argues about this. And frankly, the Court of Appeals isn't going to want to hear about somebody's dispute over the couch.
Sure.
Jim, are there some traps to be avoided by people as they consider settling their family law dispute?
I think absolutely. Look at what you're getting in kind of your long-term picture. One of the things I'll tell people is consider the assets in particular. Are you getting an asset that's tax pregnant or tax free? For instance, are you getting a 401k, an IRA? There are tax consequences associated with that asset. If somebody tells you you're getting a $10,000 IRA and I'm taking a $10,000 cash account, that's not the same thing. The cash account is cash. That's $10,000. The IRA, there's going to be taxes and potentially penalty, depending on how old you are, if you try to cash that thing out. So you've got to be wary of some of the traps. You've got to be wary as well of the assets. What do you want and what can you afford going into the future? For instance, with the house, you want the house, but can you afford to keep the house? You know, it's one thing to say on an asset list, okay, great, you know, as an equal division of assets or an equitable division of assets, I get the house. But in the long run, can I pay the first mortgage? Can I pay the second mortgage? Do I have the resources to do that? And in this economy, you have to look at, can either party afford the house? And if you can't, how do we sell it and what can we sell it for?
Do you sometimes see people coming to our office, for example, having tried to work out a settlement before they get lawyers involved? And is that a problem for them?
It is. I encourage people, get a lawyer involved as part of the settlement process. Get a lawyer involved, one, before you go. The lawyers often know, one, what it is you need, the information, the documentation. They can help you get that. Two, as part of the negotiating process, have your lawyer inform you, you know, what would I get or what may I get if I were to take this to court? You know, what are my negotiating strengths? What are my weaknesses? Finally, before you sign off on anything, have a lawyer take a look at it. In terms of language, you'll have more cases where somebody will come back 2-3 years, sometimes even less than that, after an agreement's been reached and say, you know, my God, if I would have really understood the consequences of having signed this agreement and what it says, I never would have done so. A lawyer's more apt to pick that up because we've seen these issues before. We've gone into court. We've had to litigate them.
And I assume the lawyer should be someone who's well-versed in family law as opposed to other aspects of the law.
Absolutely. You need somebody who knows family law because it's a complex and difficult area of the law. There are a lot of little niches and things that if you don't know, your client could be really adversely affected by.
What are some of the legal issues that are still fertile ground for parties to litigate in terms of their getting a divorce, at least on the financial side?
I tell you, on the financial side, non-marital tracing to me is always a real interesting issue. And by non-marital tracing, I mean the issue of a party says, look, I've got an asset that shouldn't be part of this marital pot that we're going to divide. Either I had it before we were married, I inherited it from a family member or from someone else for that matter, or it was a gift that was given just to me.
How about the lottery, winning the lottery? Is that marital or non-marital?
That, well, and again, it would depend on when you won the lottery, but if you won it during the marriage, it would certainly be marital. Now, that being said, if you won the lottery and you wanted to do a post-nup, that might not be a bad idea at that point. You could certainly say, look, here's the division of the lottery winnings and then preclude a later division of it when one party may have spent or saved a fair amount of it.
I imagine that would go over real big. I won the Powerball. Here's your share. Sorry.
So, Jim, what other legal issues are there that people ought to be thinking about during a settlement negotiation?
I tell you, spousal maintenance is a big issue that gets litigated. And there aren't guidelines such as for child support where you can go to the child support calculator, type in the income figures, and it'll give you a number out. That's really discretionary with the court, but it's kind of an experience thing.
And then finally, property division itself, I suppose, comes up quite a bit, maybe in all cases.
Yeah, and there are a number of factors that are with it that should be addressed.
Well, we're just about out of time. Jim, great to meet you. The hour went very quickly today.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it and had a great time.
Thanks so much. And Tom, next week on the program.
Well, Steve, I won't be here. Unfortunately, I'll be off vacationing in some nice spot down in Mexico. But Susan Rode will be hosting Marcia Stolt, and they'll be talking actually about a very fun topic, trademarks and branding, and what that means in the law.
All right, that is coming up next week. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. We'll be back at noon next Saturday. We've got a ball game coming up next here on News Radio 830 WCCO.